Hello everyone, my name is Rob. The following is an excerpt from a lecture that I gave as part of the Irish History and Cultural module at University College Cork Language Center in Ireland. If you want to find out anything else or other information about the course, you can take a look at the show notes for this episode. Enjoy the program.
Please,
but anyway, I love the sound of the birds in the background whenever you know.
Yes,
you,
I am in the mountains. I am in the mountains.
It sounds beautiful.
Yes, it is beautiful, the place, and I am walking, hiking every day, many hours a day.
Yeah, I'm always a bit jealous when I hear the sound of those birds. It just sounds like such a beautiful place. So it's in the mountains, is that outside of?
Yes, it is Cordoba. In the mountain, 200 kilometers from home. And I came for a week. And in this week, I want to go hiking. And I am.
All right, so you're just. Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, because even when you're coming in, when you're joining the class from your normal house, there still is a lovely sound of birds in the background.
Yes, because I live in the countryside. So that's why.
Wow, okay. Yeah. So just like your ancestors down in the Beira Peninsula.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know if you ever heard anything about Cromwell when you were growing up, or what impressions you have of him yourself, Maria Teresa.
From whom?
Of Oliver Cromwell.
Ah, well, no, I didn't know anything about him in my childhood. No, I know about him and from him. In the last, I learned a lot about him in the last 10 years, but nothing before.
Okay, yeah. So I think I was telling you is the story about my mother, you know, telling me about Oliver Cromwell when I was a child. So, you know, she was from Waterford City, as I was saying earlier, which is a walled city. And it's one, you know, in Cork today, in Cork City, you might have seen that, look, basically the walls are almost completely gone, the old city walls.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The walls in Waterford, a lot of them remain, you know, so you get a real sense of what the city would have been like. And the place where my mother grew up was basically beside the wall. And it was approximately in the place where Cromwell had camped when he laid siege upon Waterford. So it was at that site, because it's in kind of higher ground overlooking the city. So, you know, I kind of grew up with stories about Cromwell in Waterford and about how, you know, everybody in the city was extremely frightened that there was going to be another massacre, as there had been massacres, which we will talk about in a minute, in Wexford and Drogheda and other places. I think for my research, I think I have to be fair to Oliver Cromwell, as, you know, he was definitely a mass murderer, a very cruel person. But I think there were other colonists in Ireland, representing the British Crown at the same time as Oliver Cromwell, who were just as genocidal, just as cruel, and that were mass murderers as well. So I think he is sort of singled out as, you know, the devil incarnate himself. But I think there were lots of others that were just as bad. One of the books that I was reading to prepare for this talk tonight was a book by a guy called Stephen O'Shiachu, and he's a lecturer of 17th century history in Trinity College Dublin, And he published a book called God's Executioner. And it's basically mm-hmm. all about Oliver Cromwell and his time in Ireland. So he only actually spent 9 months in Ireland. But, you know, like he made quite an impression, let's say, on the people here. So we never quite forgot him. And there are lots of stories about Cromwell as well that were collected by the Folklore Commission in the 1930s. Other folklore that was collected about him in the 19th century, you know. So, and also there are contemporary records of atrocities that he committed in places like Wexford and Drogheda and elsewhere. Most of them, the vast majority of them, because Ireland was, you know, exclusively Irish speaking at the time. Almost all of those records are written in the Irish language. So a lot of English language historians, they don't know about them, you know? So if you look mm-hmm. at biographies of Cromwell in England, you'll see, you know, they look on Cromwell as being a hero. Now he was treated as a villain shortly after his death. When he died in 1659, I believe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was offered the crown of England, which he refused. But then he decided to take the title of Lord Protector for life. And then his son inherited that title, Richard Cromwell. So it basically was a monarchy in all but name. So like, in spite of the fact that like he kind of, you know, when he came around, when he first sort of came to political power, you know, he sort of appeared during the Republic, but then he very quickly made himself a dictator and essentially made himself an all-powerful king, even though he never took the title of king itself. But, you know, what was mm-hmm. there a great difference between Lord Protector and King? But because of the fact that he was responsible for the execution of Charles II, he was responsible for, you know, the decapitation of King Charles. Shortly after his death, about 10 years after his death, when Charles was reinstated, when Charles's son was reinstated to the crown and the monarchy was reestablished in England, his body was dug up from his grave and he was hung, drawn and quartered and decapitated, even though, you know, his body was already in the ground for about, you know, had been in the ground rotting for about 10 years. So it's pretty horrible. But his body was left out in the open as a warning for people, you know, not to execute the king. And his head as well, you know, was put on a spike at the entrance to London, to London Bridge. Again, just as a warning, you know, this is what happens if you kill the king. You know, you don't get away mm-hmm. with it. Even in death, you do not get away with it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, also we should remember that it's very important to be buried, you know, in the Christian religion.
Yes.
To be buried. To be buried in consecrated ground. And, you know, there's sort of resurrection of the flesh. So like people, you know, their physical remains are resurrected. So, mm-hmm. you know, it would have been a shocking thing to happen to anybody, you know, for their graves to be disturbed after their death, you know, because that would be kind of eternal damnation, if you like, or, you know, it would stop them from being one of God's chosen few, let's say. So anyway, that's what happened in the immediate aftermath in England. So for the next 200 years, Cromwell was, you know, persona non grata in England. And he was treated as a demon, just as he was in Ireland. Towards the middle 1860s, opinion started to change in England. There was a few new biographies written about him, and people started to get interested. Historians started to get interested in Republican England once again. And he was converted into kind of a hero, you know, who was somebody who was a religious Puritan, who stood up for his rights, who was a Republican, you know, a Democrat, somebody who wanted the power of Parliament to be supreme in the land, because that represented the will of the people, you know. So his reputation was renovated in England. And this culminated in a statue of Oliver Cromwell being commissioned by Parliament, and it was to be erected outside of the Palace of Westminster, where the Parliament is today, in London. Now, originally there was going to be a public subscription in order to finance this sculpture, but the Irish Parliamentary Party in Westminster, they refused to participate. But the politicians, anyway, that were sympathetic towards Cromwell, they privately collected for this statue. So there was a statue that was erected, which was financed privately, but it was still erected on the grounds of Westminster Palace. And I think this sort of reinterest in Cromwell and treating Cromwell like a hero disturbed a lot of people in Ireland, and there was a reaction against it. And there were a couple of biographies that were written about Cromwell in Ireland. One of them was by a guy called Father Murphy. Now, no relation to the Father Murphy of 1798. This is another Father Murphy. And it was basically, you know, a very kind of critical view of Cromwell's campaign in Ireland in the winter of 1649 to 50. So that sort of very, very much challenged the kind of the reinstatement of Cromwell's reputation in England. And definitely it started off, you know, this sort of concept of Cromwell being the devil incarnate in Ireland once again. And there was a couple of other biographies that came after. The biographers of Cromwell in the 19th century had a massive advantage over modern day biographers of Cromwell, because the state archives were burnt down during the Irish Civil War. Mm-hmm. So tragically, a lot of the state records about what was going on in Ireland in the 17th century, they were all destroyed, and there were no copies of them. So people like Father Murphy, when he was writing his biography, he had access to the state archives in the forecourts. So there are things, there are sources that he had access to, which modern day historians don't have access to. So there, you know, people are able to dispute what he said in his autobiography or in his biography of Cromwell, because those sources don't exist anymore. So he's been accused of making up these sources. But look, I think that's a bit unjust. You know, we must take those the sources that he used, I think we must take them at face value. You know, why shouldn't we? But anyway, that's there's some of the biographies that I've been drawing upon. So both English ones and Irish ones. And also there's a wonderful documentary on this subject, which I encourage you to watch afterwards. It is presented and written by the author of God's Executioner, that novel, right? So who is, his name is Stephen O'Shocru, right? So he's a Trinity professor of history, as I was saying. So I'll give you a link if you want to that documentary. It's on YouTube. It's okay. Well worth a watch as well, if you're interested.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
So anyway, here's a picture of Cromwell. This isn't from life. This is a painting from the 19th century. And you can see that, you know, Cromwell is kind of being depicted here as, you know, as a parliamentarian. You know, he's reading some of the law tracts. You know, he's being depicted as not really as a soldier and as somebody that was, you know, in actual fact, a mass murderer. He's being, you know, depicted here as sort of a Democrat. Here is the statue of Cromwell, which is, you can see his birth date was 1599. So this was erected in 1899 outside of the Parliament in London on the 300th anniversary of his birth. There's only two statues of people outside Parliament. One of them is Oliver Cromwell. The other one is Richard the Lionheart. And Richard the Lionheart is another strange person to have outside Parliament, because Richard the Lionheart, first of all, he never spoke English. He spent almost all of his life in France or in the Holy Land during the Crusade. In some of his own writings, he seems to have hated England. And it's another one where, you know, like he was known as Richard Coeur de Lion, right? Because that's what his name was during his lifetime. That's what he was called in France. And like I said, he never, you know, he didn't know any English, didn't speak English, had only been to England once or twice on holidays. Had no interest in England whatsoever, really. But, you know, like in the 19th century as well, during the Romantic sort of era, again, his reputation was completely transformed. And, you know, instead of being called Richard Coeur de Lion, he was Richard the Lionheart. And he was this hero, you know, and King mm-hmm. John, his brother, was this evil person, you know, and you had the stories of Robin Hood and things like that, you know. So I think these statues of Cromwell and of Richard Lionheart, they don't really tell us much about what these people were like during their lifetimes. I think they tell us about England in the 19th century, because I think each generation reassesses history for its own benefit. Yes. You know, so I think it's interesting that Cromwell was there and that they tried to change or they tried to reassess his identity and what Cromwell represents based on what was going on in the 19th century. Because, you know, I think the 19th century in England was a very important time for Parliament because of, you know, the reforms that were going in, the expansion of suffrage. You know, throughout the 19th century, more and more people get the vote. And towards the end of the 19th century, you almost have universal male suffrage. And then the beginning of the 20th century, female suffrage for women over 30 comes in. So, like, you know, it's Parliament really kind of exercising its power, and I suppose, you know, Parliament fulfilling its destiny as being, you know, a genuine democratic institution. But it seems shocking that they would have used Cromwell to promote that idea of Parliament. To an Irish person, at least, that seems shocking. You know, it's like, I mean, Hitler was democratically elected as well, I suppose. But you know,
yes,
maybe, can you imagine Hitler being, you know, a statue of Hitler outside the Reichstag today? You know, maybe that could happen in a few hundred years' time if there's a reassessment of Hitler's reputation. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, but you know, Cromwell for the Irish, I think, is what Hitler is for the Jews, let's say.
For Germany, yes. Okay.
Absolutely, yeah. So anyway, so this is how I and how the contemporaries of Cromwell remembered him as a soldier. as somebody who proved himself on the battlefield as not really a politician or certainly not a Democrat. You know, he took power and greedily kept it for himself and for his family. Remember, he handed on power to his son, not to his not to Parliament. So anyway, so looking at the 16th century England, right, there was a civil war. And on one side of the civil war, you had the king and you had the people who supported the king. They were the royalists. Now, the king at the time, Charles, you can see him there, right? He was somebody who saw himself as an absolutist king, a little bit like Louis XIV, how he was going to become in France, that he was like an all-powerful monarch. So that's the way he saw himself. And he didn't want to listen to Parliament because he thought, well, I'm the sovereign. I shouldn't have to listen to anybody. So he actually, in 1831, he closed Parliament and he only reopened Parliament at the end of the 1640s because he was forced to, because the country was going bankrupt. And he wanted to fight a war against the Scottish. Now, what was going on in Scotland to start a war? Well, up in Scotland, people were Calvinists. Okay, now in Scotland, they're called Presbyterians, or particularly in Ireland, we call them Presbyterians. But basically, Presbyterian and Calvinist is the same thing. So they're, or sometimes they're called Puritans. These were the people who emigrated to the United States as well on the Mayflower.
Yes, I know.
And who set up the 13 colonies there. You know, they were Puritans, Calvinist, Presbyterians. We would see them as, very evangelistic Christians today. In Brazil, for example, some of the people that are supporting Bolsonaro, or some of the kind of very literalistic evangelicals in the United States who are supporting Donald Trump. You know, who take the Bible and, you know, take it as that, look, every word in this Bible is
every word of
God, and taking it very literally. So Scotland went Calvinist or Presbyterian. The church that was the official church of England under the king was the Church of England. Now, the Church of England was increasingly sort of going kind of more conservative and kind of going back to being closer to the Catholic Church. And the Puritans, which are basically the Presbyterians down in England, the Puritans and the Presbyterians up in Scotland, they didn't like that at all. So up in Scotland, they revolted. They didn't want to, have to conform to the established church. They wanted to have their own services. They wanted to elect their own ministers. They don't actually have priests or reverends. They elect one of their number to be a person giving the sermon. It's a very kind of democratic approach to religion. So they wanted nothing to do with that. They refused to participate in the established church. So Charles, of course, being an absolutist king, didn't want anything to do with this. So he declared war on Scotland and he needed money to raise an army. So he had to call Parliament back again. And Parliament basically were like, look, yeah, you can have your money for this campaign in Scotland. We agree with that. But, now that Parliament was opened again, we want you to do something for us. We want you to listen to Parliament so then this sort of created a conflict between the king and Parliament. And that erupted, particularly when Charles's campaigns in Scotland weren't very successful. So Cromwell emerged as a force to be reckoned with in Parliament. And he proved himself as a great soldier, and he was responsible for the raising of a new army called the New Model Army, which, for example, would be, you know, highly disciplined, that focused a lot on training, on new military techniques, also not having soldiers from the local area, basing soldiers in barracks that were away from their local homes, you know, and professionalizing the army. So he proved himself a very, very effective soldier. And he was involved in the suppression of the royalist forces in England. You can see some of the battles here, battle in Edge Hill, and then in Walton Moor in 1643, and then Marston Moor. And you can see that the green area there is expanding, you know, that the parliamentarians are kind of defeating the royalists. And the king during this time set up his palace, his court in Oxford. So Oxford remained loyal to the king. So that's the little red part that you can see near to London there. Eventually they defeated most of the power, but Ireland, right, they kind of saw this as an opportunity to rebel against the plantation. Now, there had been a plantation of Ulster in the early 17th century, okay? This is after the Nine Years' War, the war that was led by Hugh O'Neill. And there was the Battle of the Boyne, which was lost, and King James fled the battlefield. He was forever known in the Irish tradition as Seamus an Chach, which is Seamus the shit. So that's the name that he was given by the Irish people in poems and things like that. He fled the battlefield, even though he hadn't lost. And that was in 1690. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit confused myself here. There was a battle in Kinsale in 1601, when the Irish forces were led by Hugh O'Neill. And they were allied with the Spanish. Unfortunately, they lost that. And a lot of the landowning Gaelic aristocracy fled the country in 1609 with the flight of the Earls. That freed up a lot of land in Ulster. And then the English started a plantation of Ulster. So that's why today, you know, you have a majority unionist population in the north of Ireland, because of those plantations that were started from the departure of O'Neill and his allies, O'Donnell, up in Ulster, right? So that was going on up there. So things were, obviously, people were very angry about their land having been stolen. And when civil war broke out in England, there was a rebellion in Ireland. Now, there had been like a number of atrocities committed against the Catholic Irish, not just in Ulster, but in Munster as well. Thousands and thousands of people were being murdered. Civilians, soldiers, it didn't matter, women, children. So there was a lot of anger on the part of the Catholic Irish. So when civil war broke out, there were atrocities committed by the Catholic Irish against the Protestant planters, the Protestant Unionist planters up in Ulster. And there were terrible atrocities as well committed. So this is in 1641. Now, these atrocities, they pale in comparison to the atrocities that were committed against the Irish. But still, look, an atrocity is an atrocity. And these were, you know, there were innocent women and children murdered by the people during the rebellion from the Irish Catholic side. There's one famous occasion on the River Bann, where they forced some Protestant civilians into the River Bann, where they drowned, and some of them tried to get out of the river, but they cut them down and forced them to go back, and they drowned. During the marches, right, that you have in Ulster, in the commemoration of the 1690 Battle of the Boyne, with James II, Seamus an Chach, they commemorate this event, right, when all these people were drowned. So they have banners with you know, paintings of that. So it's something that they never forget. These the stories of these atrocities committed by the Catholic Irish against the Protestant planters, they were spread all over England. Now, this was the very early days of printing, and there were kind of comic books that were going around depicting some of the events of the atrocities committed by the native Irish against the planters in Ireland and other atrocities. And these sort of created a huge rage amongst the parliamentarians in particular. And also, as the stories spread, they were embellished, and they were, instead of, you know, hundreds being killed, there were thousands being killed. Instead of thousands being killed, there were hundreds of thousands. This was the greatest atrocity ever committed. So even though Cromwell, he had to deal with the royalist forces in England first, it was always his intention to go back and to crush the Irish rebellion and to get revenge against these atrocities, right, that were committed against the planters. And so that was all in his mind, but he couldn't do it yet. And also he was nervous about there being a royalist attack launched on England from Ireland. So this was, you know, this was always a danger as well. Now, you can read royalist and native Irish as being the same force. Right. So the royalists were Catholic, and the Catholics were royalists. Or if they weren't Catholic, they were sympathetic to a Catholic king getting back on the throne. OK, so. So anyway, there was a trial of the king right towards the end of the 1640s, and the king was found guilty. And he was executed. Here's a contemporary drawing of his trial in Westminster. Okay, so this is the king. And he gave a very famous speech as well on the day of his execution. Now, whatever kind of king Charles was, people who saw his execution take place, they say that he was very brave at the moment of his execution. And he gave a speech to the assembled crowd just before his decapitation. And this speech became very famous as well. It was copied out and it was turned into a pamphlet, and with the printing press and everything was spread all around the country. People, you know, kind of were becoming a bit more sympathetic towards the king, even though he was dead. But, you know, that's why they wanted to spread these stories about the Catholic Irish, you know, to counteract the propaganda that was being spread about the king. Here's a contemporary drawing as well, a bit of a graphic drawing of King Charles's head after the execution. This was the kind of stuff that was being, you know, you being, this is from one of the pamphlets that were published at the time. Okay, now, Cromwell invaded Ireland in 1649. You can see right at the start of the rebellion, you can see that the Catholic ownership of the land in Ireland is, you know, most of the land in Ireland is owned by Catholics, right? Between 50 to 100%, particularly in the south of Ireland, okay? Now, this is made up by what we call the Old English, who were people like the, you know, who were just as Irish as the Irish. Níos Gaeilí ná na Gael iad Héin, translated into English, is more Irish than the Irish themselves. Families like the Barrys and the Roaches. And so you had the Old English and you also had the Gaelic Irish together. Both of those groups of people, they stuck with the Catholic religion and they refused to fail. So the vast majority of Ireland remained Catholic. The part that you can see in the north that is Protestant-owned land was given to the planters, right, in the after 1609, after the flight of the Earls. Now you can see, right, after the Cromwellian conquest of Ireland, basically all of the land, right, the land of your ancestors as well in the Beira Peninsula, you know, they no longer own their land anymore. They were renting their land. So you can see that, you know, whatever about any other conquests of Ireland, this was a real conquering of Ireland. You know, like the people were either banished from their land, or if they were left to stay in their land, they had to rent it. And the rent was three times on average, right? At least during the 19th century, the rent for those people was three times the rent that it would be in England for similar quality of land. So they were only ever allowed to stay on their land by paying enormous, ridiculous rents. Okay. And yeah, so it's a complete revolution. Cromwell is very famous for this line. He said, "To hell or to Connacht." Right. So that's what he said to the Catholic Irish.
Sorry. Can you repeat what? Yes.
Yeah. So he said, "To hell or to Connacht." Right. And so Connacht is the province there that you can see.
In the province. Yes.
Yeah. Now, the reason why he sent people to Connacht was because, you know, I'm sure you've probably been to Connacht. It's full of rocks. You know, the land is invaluable at all. It's, you can't grow anything on it. It's got rocks everywhere. It's, and if it's not got rocks, it's boggy, or it's there's a lot of lakes there. You know, it's just very, it's useless land, right? So it was set up as a reservation, similar to the reservations that were set up by the United States government for Native American peoples. You know, so, and similar injustice. So, you know, this was kind of a ring fence, an open air prison, if you like. You know, maybe some people might say that that's too extreme a description, but I think similar to an open air prison. And those who were forced to leave the country, if they were soldiers, they would join the Spanish army, the French army, or the Austrian army. A lot of O'Sullivan's did that, you know, if they were anyway aristocratic, you know, they would have been, their profession would have been soldiery, so they would have gone, they would have joined a lot of the continental armies. And then there were a lot of Irish who were sent off as slaves to work in sugar plantations in the Caribbean. Okay, so this is where you get a lot of the, you know, the white slaves working in places like Barbados, Jamaica, you know, all of these British controlled islands in the Caribbean to work in these sugar plantations. So this was as well before, you know, African slaves became more accessible to Europeans, to the English in particular, you know, because remember, you know, they didn't really have access to these, to the interior of Africa to get these slaves. So they were used as a slave labor for about 100 years or so, until it was discovered that, you know, that the African, West Africans in particular, could withstand the sun, the very strong sun of the Caribbean, a bit better. And they became more popular for slave owners because they could work more hours, basically. So the Irish were not as popular as slaves, but primarily they were the most popular, let's say, slaves or the most common slaves found in the Caribbean, found in the sugar plantations during that time. So you can see, right, that it was absolutely devastating. Another effect as well of Cromwell's conquest of Ireland was he employed, right, a military technique called scorched earth. Okay, scorched earth. Now, scorch is like burn, right? So you burn the land. And it's a technique that was used, for example, by the Red Army when the Red Army was retreating into, let's say, past the Ural Mountains, right? After the Nazi attack on the Soviet Union in 1941, they used the scorched earth technique. So basically they wanted to completely destroy all of the food in the country, all of the agricultural grain, all of the wheat and barley and whatever food was available, to completely destroy that, burn any sheep or cows or anything like that, so that the enemy wouldn't have any food. That was a technique that Cromwell used in Ireland. There were counties that were declared outlaw counties, and basically they burnt all of the agricultural produce on the fields there. And so to completely starve out the enemy. Now, maybe it might have had the intended effect on the enemy, but also, you know, the ordinary people of Ireland just basically completely starved. So the estimations for the reduction in population size during the 1640s was similar to that of the Great Famine. So about 25% of the Irish population disappears. Now, this is 25% of the total population. It's about, you know, 40% of the native Irish population is just disappears, mostly from starvation, but a large percentage as well from massacres instigated by Cromwell and his soldiers. Now, why did Cromwell need all this land? Well, he needed all the land because wars are expensive. He was being financed by you know, businessmen and banks in London, and he had to pay them back. And how could he pay them back? How could he pay his soldiers? Well, the one thing that he did have was land. So this is how he financed his war, not just in Ireland, but in England. So the Irish paid for this campaign, if you like. The land then was given to Cromwell's soldiers, and some of them sold it, but some of them kept the land, and then they stayed in Ireland for the next kind of few hundred years. So, you know, like a lot of the people who still owned some of the land in Ireland up until the 20th century, they would have been the ancestors of Cromwell's soldiers, right, who got this land from Cromwell as payment for taking part in this campaign or these massacres. So here's a contemporary painting or I think it's a wood cutting from 1649. And this is a painting of what was going on in Drogheda. So Cromwell arrived in Ireland in the late summer of 1649. He immediately moved his forces up the Drogheda. That was the main royalist slash native Catholic stronghold in the eastern coast of Ireland at the time. And I think he needed to teach the Irish or the royalists as well a lesson in Ireland. So anyway, he laid siege upon the city. The city had high walls. It was well defended. So it took him a long time. It took him 10 days to eventually penetrate one of the walls. Now, Cromwell, if you can see on this picture here, he was on the southern side of the river. So that's where his armies were. They weren't on the northern side. So they eventually, with their cannons, now he had access to a lot of money. Also, he had access to the seas, and he could bring cannons up, and he could bombard the wall. So eventually destroyed one of the walls there in the southern part of Drogheda, and his forces went in. Now, when he was leading his soldiers in, he said to his soldiers, thou shalt give no quarter. Now, what that means in modern English is you're not going to take any prisoners. Okay, mm-hmm. So kill everybody. And he said in his own letter to Parliament, which I'm going to quote from in a minute, that when he saw some of his own soldiers that had been killed, he got angry and he said, look, thou shalt give no quarter. Instead of, you know, killing all of the like, let's say, armed soldiers or even like prisoners that they had taken, the soldiers, they murdered everybody. Now, it's not 100% clear whether Cromwell wanted to do this or not, according to his own accounts, but according to accounts of people that were there from the Irish side, they deliberately went about killing civilians as well inside the city. So there are a couple of notorious events. So here's a picture again of the city. You can see that he's occupying the high ground above Drogheda and using mm-hmm. his cannons. And this is just before he takes the city. Here's another contemporary depiction of the same thing. Okay, so this is a picture of modern day Drogheda. You can see you have the river mm-hmm. here in the foreground, right? So most of the city is in the north side. Now, there was a drawbridge. There was only one bridge connecting the south to the north of the city. There was a drawbridge, you know, a bridge that you can bring up. Now, unfortunately, mm-hmm. the defenders, they didn't manage to raise the drawbridge. So Cromwell's forces were able to go into the northern side of the city as well. And a lot of people, civilians, women and children, but also some soldiers, they occupied St. Peter's Church. Now, the churches, right, they act irrespective of what denomination the church is from. If you go into a church, the church gives you sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But Cromwell didn't respect the sanctuary of the people inside the church, and they locked the door and they burnt the church.
The church.
With the people inside screaming, right? So here is Cromwell's own depiction of our own comment as to what happened there. Let me get this, right? So this is from his letter to William Linthal in 1649, who was the Speaker of the House of Parliament. So this was written just after he took Drogheda. So I forbade them to spare any. So I forbade them as my soldiers to spare any that were in arms in the town. So I told them to kill everybody, mm-hmm. even if mm-hmm. they surrendered. Don't take mm-hmm. any prisoners, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think that night they put to the sword about 2,000 men. Divers of the officers and soldiers being fled over the bridge into the other part of the town. There were about 100 of them possessed in St. Peter's Church steeple, some at Westgate. Now, you can see where St. Peter's Church is here. Right, yes. So I'm just showing you on the map where it is, okay?
Yes, and yes, then, I see the point, the dot.
The gate, the west gate as well is here. And that actually in my blue circle is in the wrong place, should be mm-hmm. on the other side there. And then also other people occupied this tower. This was called St. Sunday's Tower. You know, you'll see he'll mention that in a second. Other eyewitnesses describe 300 people being in the church. Oh. But anyway, he says there were 100 of them in there. Some occupied the west gate and others a strong white round tower next to the gate called St. Sunday's. So here is St. Sunday's. Mm-hmm. This one here. Okay. And yes. They're still in existence today, as you can see. Okay, yes. So anyway, they occupied St. Sunday's. These being summoned to yield to mercy, so they were asked to come out. They refused, whereupon I ordered the steeple of St. Peter's Church to be set on fire, to be fired. When one mm-hmm. of them was heard to say in the midst of the flames, God damn me, God confound me, I burn, I burn. Now, Cromwell obviously tries to make himself look, you know, like a reasonable person. But other depictions of what were going on that were written in Irish say that, you know, there were women and children. They were asking to come out. But, you know, it happened very, very fast that they'd locked the gates of the door of the church and burnt it down, knowing that there were innocent civilians inside there.
Mm. Oh my God.
There was also the Lord Mayor of the city of Drogheda. He had lost a leg in battle. So he had a wooden leg. And they beat him to death with his own leg.
Ah.
Just outside St. Peter's Church. Yeah. They were looking for, he was rumored to have gold in his leg, in his wooden leg. So they were saying they were looking for that.
Ah, oh my God.
That was the excuse anyway.
The reason.
Okay, so yeah. Other accounts of what was going on in Drogheda say that the streets were running with blood. Any priests, of course, any Catholic priests that they found were to be hung on the spot. Mm-hmm. So many people perished. And, you know, like you can see another thing that he says, right, after Drogheda, right, he says, look, this is righteous judgment. This is the righteous judgment of God upon these barbarous wretches. Mm. Right? So he's saying, look, that he mm-hmm. is the instrument of God's punishment on these Catholics, okay? Who have imbrued their hands in so much innocent blood, right? So he's talking about the blood that was spilled by, you know, the Protestant planters in 1641. Even though like these individuals that were in the church, for example, had nothing to do with that. And it will tend to prevent the effusion of blood for the future. So he's saying, look, that this will make other people think twice about defending their cities, right? It will make the Irish and the Royalists think twice about carrying on this war against us. So it's the preventative war, which is the argument that's often used by modern forces like the United States in Iraq in 2003 under George Bush. Their argument was, you know, this is to prevent, you know, weapons of mass destruction being used in the future. Okay.
And that is now. I mean, that was not 1641. It is. It was in 2001.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. And also, you know, the same sort of moral argument was used by the Americans, by the US, when they dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? So they were able to say, look, this will prevent further spilling of blood. And this is something that's not new in Ireland. There was a law that had been instituted at the beginning of the 17th century, which was also a preventative law. So it meant that in the cities of Cork and Dublin, Catholics could be arrested and executed based on crimes that they hadn't yet committed. So this was something, that was put into law in the early 1600s. So it's something, you know, it's not new that he's saying, look, you know, I'm going to murder all these people because, you know, this will send a warning out and it will stop anybody else from making a stand against me. So anyway, this is his argument. Now you can see, obviously, Cromwell is trying to paint himself as a reasonable person. You know, he saw himself as a Christian, and, you know, he makes an argument to make himself look like, you know, he wasn't murdering people in cold blood. He wasn't murdering civilians. Okay. And, I don't think we can have a problem with him murdering soldiers, right? Because, you know, all's fair in love and war, as they say. But, you know, murdering civilians, I think, at the time, was seen as that, look, that's something that you don't do. Women and children and old and infirm people, their lives should be spared. But Cromwell ignored that. So anyway, this is a righteous judgment of God upon these barbarous wretches who have imbrued their hands, who have covered their hands in so much innocent blood, that it will tend to prevent the effusion of blood for the future. Okay, so it's a preventative measure, which are the satisfactory grounds to such actions. So which justify my massacre here, which otherwise cannot work remorse and regret. Okay, so that's what happened in Drogheda. Of course, Drogheda, you know, puts the fear of God into the rebels, the royalists, and the people defending some of the other cities around Ireland. Now, Wexford is a place that is acting as a harbour, a safe haven for royalist privateers. Now, what are privateers? Privateers are basically paid pirates, okay, or officially sanctioned pirates. So they were pirates that were picking off English merchant ships, particularly in the mouth of the River Thames, going into London, you know, from, let's say, the New World, bringing riches back from the colonies. They were picking them off, and they were stealing them, and they were sinking them, and, you know, they were causing enormous economic, an enormous amount of economic damage to Cromwell and to the parliamentarians. So Wexford had to come next. So he marched down in October of 1649, all the way down to Wexford there in the southeast corner of Ireland. And in Wexford, there is another massacre. Now, this one is even more controversial, if that's possible. One of the reasons why it's so controversial was that because people in Wexford had heard about what had happened in Drogheda, they decided to, you know, negotiate with Cromwell, right? And during negotiations, Cromwell's soldiers attacked the city, right? So can you imagine that all of the defenders, of course, were relaxing because they thought mm-hmm. that they were in negotiations, you know, mm-hmm. and there was a truce. But his soldiers ignored the truce and went in to Wexford and caused havoc. There was a similar scale of massacre in Wexford. We have one important piece of documentary evidence about 300 women being burnt to death in the bullring in Wexford. Now, this is a picture of Wexford today, down at the quay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is the bullring in modern day Wexford, right? So there are 300 women. They all crowded together here in the bullring, asking for mercy from Cromwell and his soldiers. They weren't given mercy.
Sorry, Rob. Can you repeat yep. the word you said? That is the, what is the, what I am seeing?
The bullring. It's the bullring in Wexford.
Bullring.
Right, so it would be where they had the market, you know? Because there's a lot of good dairy land in Wexford. So there would be a market and people would bring in their bulls, and then there would be a bull that would be sort of given first prize. Waterford City has a bullring as well. And some of the other cities, like in the southeast, there have bullrings. The women crowded there in the center, like in the central marketplace in Wexford, 300 of them who were murdered in cold blood. To send a warning. Now, historians such as Stefan O. Siachru has compared the moral argument to the moral argument that was used again by the United States. Why did they have to drop a bomb in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Wouldn't Hiroshima mm-hmm. have done? Why did it have to be two places? Cromwell does the same thing, maybe. We can only speculate because Cromwell, he remains very silent after this massacre. Maybe because he lost control of his soldiers. It must be some kind of sign, historians believe, of a guilty conscience. So we don't really have any of Cromwell's letters about what happened here. Now, remember, Cromwell was sending daily letters back to the Parliament, letting them know what was going on. So mm-hmm. there's no letter for this period. So that in itself, historians see it as, you know, almost an admission of guilt, mm-hmm. right? Or at least showing that he was very unhappy because he lost control of his soldiers. So anyway, that's another notorious event. And they went on to lay siege upon Kilkenny, and they crossed the river at New Ross. Kilkenny was where the government, the royalist government was. They took that. Cork and Youghal were actually, and Bandon were sympathetic to Cromwell. They were being held by parliamentarians. So Cromwell spent the summer or the winter, sorry, of 49-50 in Cork, and then in Youghal, and then he left Youghal in March of 1650 to return back to England. Now, he left his son-in-law in charge of his forces there, and the Scorched Earth campaign was continued. They basically burnt down the farmers' crops in almost all of the counties that you can see in the southern half of the country. And this is what resulted in so much starvation, so much hunger. As I said, there were 50,000 slaves that were sent off to the Caribbean. And because there was so much starvation and there was so much malnutrition, in the summer of 1650, just like during the famine, disease started to spread, cholera, typhus, dysentery, and that killed enormous numbers as well. I'm going to leave it there now for the time being, and because we're at 1951, so I'll stop sharing the screen there and just see if you've got any questions.
Yes, I have a question, Rob. If the people the planters, they were Scottish people, and they were experiencing the same thing than the people in Ireland. I don't understand why they insisted on going on a place where they were loyalists. Were they loyalists, not Scottish rebels? I mean, because they were experiencing the same thing as the people in Ireland, the same oppression, like, I mean.
When they started the plantation in Ulster, they had two requirements. First of all, you had to speak English, right? And remember, like in Scotland, most of the people in Scotland spoke Gaelic, Irish, or the Irish, right? At that time, it wasn't known as Scottish Gaelic anymore. It was just the same language. They were forbidden to come to Ireland. They were forbidden to get any land. They also forbade any Catholics from Scotland or England getting any land in Ireland. So they had to be Protestant and they had to be English speaking. Okay, so you had people coming from lowland Scotland, which were basically, you know, culturally, they would be similar, let's say, to the English, you know. Now they didn't want any Welsh people either there. You know, they weren't trusted either, or people from Cornwall who spoke Cornish, you know, so they wanted English speakers there. So that was the two primary requirements. You had to speak English and you had to be a Protestant. Now, I suppose there were people for whom, you know, getting land for free almost, was an amazing offer. You know, if you're in a place, so, you know, you can't blame people for taking up the offer. Always going to find people that will
I don't complain. No, I don't blame them at all. But I was wondering if they were living in and experiencing the same situation, the same oppression than the Irish, why they did accept that offer.
I cannot understand.
Well.
Yeah. So you know, because they were, I suppose they were English speaking and they were, you know, definitely very sympathetic to England. Yeah. But there were
loyalists.
That they were you had in Ireland in 1641, right? The population was approximately 700,000 or 800,000 Catholics, native Catholics, okay, both Old English and Gaelic Irish.
In Ulster.
In the whole country.
Ah, in the whole country. Mm-hmm.
Right, in 1641. This is an estimation anyway, by Stefano O'Sherchru in his book. That's what he says. So 800,000 of them were Catholic. And then you had 200,000 English planters, now both in the south and in the north. Okay, now they were members of the Church of England, the established church. And then you had 100,000 Presbyterians or Calvinists who were Lowland Scots. Lowland English-speaking Scots, you know. So that was the makeup. And then of that, about 300,000 of those native Irish were killed. So 300,000, maybe 350,000 historians are they're the kind of figures that you get. So anyway, a good kind of 25% of the population. So it was 1.1 million. So 25% of that.
Oh my
250 God. To 300,000. Yeah, approximately 300,000. So like in terms of percentages, you know, it was a very devastating time.
Yes, I can imagine. Yes.
And, you know, I think the importance of the Cromwellian conquest is that it sets into place everything that goes after. So, like, the injustices that are begun under Cromwell, they continue with the penal laws, they continue with the oppression of the native Catholics in Northern Ireland after the founding of Northern Ireland. You know, like that, it sets up a two-tier state where you have the subjects, which are, you know, the members of the Protestant churches, and you have the non-subjects, basically the Irish. In a similar way to what you get in, you know, like for example in the Belgian Congo, or with, you know, the Mexicans, you know, under the Spanish, after they took over that country, you know, there's very much kind of two societies. You know, the Irish are very much seen as, you know, I think I hate to use this word, but basically subhuman. I think that's the way they're treated in the law anyway. That if you're an Irish Catholic, you're subhuman. Like even there were Irish, for example, the O'Briens in Cork City, right? The O'Brien, they own land in Cork City. Okay, now they were originally Gaelic lords from County Clare, like descendants of Brian Boru. Now they went Protestant, and they remained loyal to the parliamentarians, to the English, particularly during like the 9 year war, the Battle of Kinsale. You know, they, like the O'Briens, remained loyal to the English. Now they were Irish, so it didn't matter that they were Protestant, they still weren't equal. So like the English Protestants would never see the Irish Protestants as being their equal. They were still to some degree subhuman based on their ethnicity.
Yes. Okay. A very sad story, not a story because it's true. It's not a story.
It is very sad. Mm-hmm. Anyway, look, let's leave it there. So tonight, Tere, thank you very much for coming, as
Thank you very much. And sorry for the camera, but I don't know what happened. I cannot use it. Okay.
No problem. Thank you. No problem at all.
Bye.
Thank
you.
Don't worry about it. Okay,
bye, Emilien. Bye, Rob.
Bye. Bye.